Thank you. Thank you for coming. You heard the instruction, the introduction you had already, that I was born in Berlin. I had one brother, and in 1932, indeed, we moved to Holland because my mother got entangled in a group of youngsters who were calling slogans and were rowdy in Berlin. And my father had been working from Holland in some representation of factories. So, and he came home every time when he had been on the road. And my mother said to him, she didn't want to stay in Berlin anymore with the kids. He had to see that we come to Holland too, which we did in June 1932. We went to school there. The times were very hard because not only for the immigrants, but also for the people themselves. There was depression and unemployment. And in the only way the immigrants from Germany were frowned a bit, little bit about, but that there were some more people wanting jobs. But in general, there was no anti-Semitism. There were a lot of Jewish expressions used in the Dutch language, daily use of words and expressions, which were mostly humorous. And my mother went, on the advice of her sister, came back to Berlin to learn a trade. She had never worked in her life. She learned how to make intimate apparel for heavyset women. You couldn't buy that in those years. So you had to have it made to measure. And with this, she kept our family fairly decently going. I had to leave the art school when I was 15 and a half and do the household. My father had been taking care of it partly, but now he didn't want to do that anymore. He was the assistant of my mother in bookkeeping and whatever. And I had to leave school. It was not the nicest thing, but anyway, it happened. I had little side jobs, babysitting, library arranging for somebody who was printing books, mending socks, mending all kinds of things for 10 cents an hour. I could keep my money, but I had to buy my clothes and extras for it myself. The only thing which I established at that time, I bought a second-hand bike for $10, 10 guilders. But I had a flat tire every corner of the street. So I had a set of spoons from the kitchen with me and some patches and the glue to put a patch on. And it became quite handy in taking tire off practically every corner and put a patch on and went on. And my first memory of the result of my working was two new tires for my bicycle. I can still smell the scent of that bicycle straw. Well, anyway, that just was the idea of giving an example how we used to live. We didn't have anything what people have nowadays. We had to improvise games to play on the streets and in the open fields. Do it yourself, not like everybody getting everything what you want nowadays. But we grew up too. In 1940, I was at the kibbutz in Holland. It was a kibbutz where people from Germany had come, young people, waiting to go to Palestine, Israel now. I had gotten engaged to a young man who was very religious. I have been brought up Reform. So I had to learn the ways of keeping whole house and cooking and whatever from the Orthodox part. There were about 30 guys there, and we were four girls taking care of the household, the cooking, the washing, and in between also went to farmers to help in harvesting, in my case, strawberries. When the Germans came, I was there. My parents were in Holland. My fiancé was inducted in the Dutch army, and the people from the kibbutz decided we got to get out of here. We were close to a port city and walked to that port where beforehand, the Queen and the Cabinet had left for England, illusionary trying to get a transport, a boat, a ship, or whatever, to get to England. But of course, you needed a lot of money to do that. That had priority, and we didn't stand a chance. And I was the only one who was happy about it, because I had my family there. The other people didn't have any connection. After a while, I went home and stayed home. And then the Germans started putting in, after the three-day war, the fourth day, Holland surrendered. And in the beginning, the Germans did not do anything which would be outstanding. They didn't mingle with things or putting in orders or whatever. But the first thing they did was install a group of formerly important people from the society to serve as their order takers. The Germans themselves did very little, but they gave this committee the orders which have to be done. First, it started with every Jew had to bring its radios in, the bank accounts numbers, the cars were out of the possibility. It was later done to the complete people of the occupied countries, but the Jews were the first ones where they experimented with how to do it. In 1941, the family of my husband got their visas to the United States, which they had applied right after the war ended in Holland. And the visas came in the day Pearl Harbor was bombed. Now, there was no chance to get out of the country anymore, because now America was involved in the war. And in contract of what the other countries had so far, they could still go someplace, but there was no way to go anyplace anymore. To Spain, that would be one thing, Portugal, and the unoccupied part of France, but it wasn't safe. And my two brothers-in-law, were both attorneys, made contact with a high-placed German officer. And through the intermission of a young Swiss young man who was befriended with these officers, they managed to try to buy us out. The money was already in other countries, otherwise we wouldn't have gotten our visas either for America. So they promised a decent amount of money in order to let us go. In between time, all Dutchmen had to come and get their identification papers, like the old-fashioned driver's license with a picture and two thumbprints on it. I think it's on there. Yeah, that's there where the thumbprints are. And the underground started by first soliciting at people to surrender their, and not Jewish people, to surrender their identification cards, and then I, amongst them, started falsifying them by soaking the picture part off, because on the other side was that thumbprint, and replacing it with the picture of the person who got those papers, and they became a different person then, not Jewish, and had to be very aware what name they had, where they were living, and some background of the families. I myself had one, and I went shopping at any time when the Jewish people were not allowed to shop anymore. They had to go to certain stores at certain times. No public transportation, no schools, only a few Jewish schools. University of my husband was over. Everything was limited and restricted. And with that restriction came also, with the papers, a big yellow star, which you had to wear on your outer clothing. I had mine on a raincoat. I haven't got it here now. Like a dowel. And took my raincoat over my arm to go to any place where I was not supposed to go with the star. Only one time my father got some warning that if they would see me again without a star, then they would call the police. So I had to stay away from our old neighborhood, not to be too much pressuring other people to do things. In September 42, my brother got his notice that he had to come and present himself to be sent to another country to be working for the Germans. And they had made nice stories, like the families could go together and could live together and could build their own lives again in an uncivilized part of Europe, which didn't have too many people there. You believed it, but still were sarcastic about it. And I must say, the Germans had put a system in where one person couldn't trust the other anymore. So very little seeped out. It was kept everything in secret because the people themselves were not supposed to know it. My father sometimes played cards with a group of men, and one of them was not Jewish, had a brother in the army. And from that brother, he heard some information. Even the soldiers didn't know too much about it, but he heard that there was gas used someplace. In total, the first call was for young men to build something someplace else. Turned out to be they were the ones who started building the concentration camps, and we never heard of them again. And then when my brother got the call, we decided my parents had to go into hiding. My mother went on a farm in Holland. My father had his card-playing compies who wanted only to take one person, and my brother had to go someplace where it turned out was not safe, came to my in-law's house and told me that it wasn't safe, so he went to an address where we had rented a room some time ago when my husband was still in the university to be easier accessible, had furnished it, and that's where my brother went into hiding. It turned out that this house later became an in-between place for shutdown pilots and heavy underground work. My mother couldn't speak too well Dutch. She always tried to bribe us kids to teach her, but we didn't have the patience to. And in order to be visible in that small town on the farm, we had said, well, she was a poor, bombed-out woman from Rotterdam. Amongst that, Rotterdam was the cause of surrendering because they had bombed it very much. And the farm people said she was a relative, and from the shock of the bombardment where she lost everything, she had lost her way of speaking. So she had to keep her mouth shut at all times. And even on her false papers, I had put down speech impairment. It was okay there. For my mother, it was okay. But later, all the people in that area were evacuated by the Germans, and she finished up with my brother in this place which we had furnished. But in that time, we had gotten the visas which my in-laws had applied for the United States right away after the war started in Holland. We got the visas at the day that Pearl Harbor was bombed, so it was no way of going anymore. And my brother's in-law had taken contact with this young man to get us out. And finally, after my parents were in hiding, my father had gotten some valuables, not much, out of the house. There's more involved to it, but that doesn't have to do with the story too much. They were in hiding, and we were going to go and look some other way to get out. He made contact with a high officer. We were not called, like other people, to come and present ourselves in a collection camp to go east, to be transferred to another area. We got married because we thought if we would have the same name, we should stay together. But we never had the religious ceremony. That was for when he had his doctorate and we would be normal again. But my one brother-in-law was married to a non-Jewish woman, and they had a baby just before we were told to leave. And the message came through that she could not come along with the baby. It would be too tiresome for her. A big red flag. Nobody saw it. We were ordered, told, to come with one suitcase each to the central station in Amsterdam, where we would go with the express train to Switzerland. I remember my father standing without his star in the back in the railroad station, blinking me goodbye. You couldn't even gesture to each other because that would have been dangerous. And we were placed in a reserved train compartment. The trains had a hallway and all little compartments with sliding doors and some windows in it, and they had reserved one for us and another family, mother, father, son, and daughter our age. They turned out to be diamond people and had the money to buy themselves free too. Of course, my mother-in-law, father-in-law had died already, my mother-in-law had to surrender the possession of goods in the other countries. She had to give a written or whatever notice. I was not involved in it, so I didn't know. And when we were in that train, that German came by, he was in civics, not in our compartment, and said, "Listen, when we get to the first German city, you have to get out because you have to get your Swiss visas and your passports. If you're geared to one thing, you don't hear, see, or know anything." That should have been for us the notice that is a lost case. Because if there would be a Swiss consulate in Germany, it would have been in Holland too. It was a neutral country. And as soon as we stepped out of the train, we got arrested by the Gestapo, taken to the Gestapo prison, and separately kept and interrogated, that they wanted to try to find out where was the money. We didn't know anything, so-called. So after 3 days, they let us go, meaning that we were taken to a boxcar in Cologne on the station, where they had already raided for other people to catch, Jewish people. And we were sent with, I don't know how many people were in there. I'm very bad in figures guessing. I never did. So we were sent with a group of German Jews to the central point in Germany, Berlin. Berlin was a boys' school, a former Jewish boys' school, of which I knew that the brother of a friend of my mother's from childhood on had been the headmaster there. And when we arrived in this place, you didn't know where you were going, what was happening, I asked if some of my German relatives by any chance were still there, and I heard that my uncle and family was just deported a few weeks ago. But that friend of my mother's friend, the brother, he was in charge of this place. So I went downstairs to his office, knocked on the door, and came in and introduced myself. He fell off his chair practically. "What are you doing here? How come? How did you come here?" So we told him a little bit, and he couldn't do a thing because he had to send his mother to a camp already a week ago. But he could choose a different camp for her, of course, which was probably not as bad as the other. He couldn't do a thing. The friend of my mother's was obviously working for him. And she came and visited us twice, but that was all I saw of her. So we didn't have any chance there. But that same day, a Dutch truck driver came to that building delivering goods. And we heard the Dutch people calling. We went there and we got in touch with him. He gave me his address in Berlin. If we could get out of the building, we should come there. They would help us further. He asked if I wanted some message to send to somebody, and I wrote a long letter to my parents, delivered to the in-between address of where my father was hiding. This was a Danish woman who was living in the lower apartment, and my father was hiding in the upper apartment of that building. And this and he took the letter to this address, so my father knew what was going on. My mother was in the country, so he wasn't in touch with her either. And he saw to it that my aunt from Switzerland sent some packages and some money to the camp, which my husband and his family received, because I was, in the meantime, had a sore throat, got to the nurse, was put aside, and was told I had scarlet fever. I had to go for quarantine to the Jewish hospital. Meanwhile, I learned that there was a Dr. Lustig, and Lustig is my maiden name. Dr. Lustig was in the building, and I went to him and asked him for help. Oh no, he didn't want anything to do with me. He had enough troubles himself. So that was out. But when I was put aside in that sick room in the school, there was another young doctor who said, well, I'll take you to the hospital. His name was Dr. Ehrlich, and that means honest. And he was really a nice, honest guy. But I finished up in the hospital with another Jewish young woman who was White Russian. And at that time, the White Russians were still protected by the Germans. That they were not enemies yet. So the Jewish White Russians were not enemies either. And her mother came and visited often and brought things and took cards and notes for me, written like her daughter would have written it, explaining in code, more or less, what happened. And you would write, for instance, such and such is with such and such. With the other such and such was dead already. Then they knew that person had died or was gone, whatever. Then that went on for 6 weeks. I was sent back to the collection camp from the hospital. And a week later, my husband was there, but my two brothers-in-law and my mother-in-law has been sent on a transfer east. My husband was kept there to wait for me. How generous. And we were sent, the two of us together, with a whole group of German Jews back east. It took longer than any train ride would take, because in Germany, the wheels for the army had to roll first, and then every train was put on a side rail and had to wait till those wheels were gone, and that's what took a longer time to get there. We were in a boxcar, a closed boxcar in this case. We had a bucket for facility, but nothing else. And our suitcases went with it. Everybody had to take one suitcase, and they came with us. After about we were put there in the afternoon, I guess. The night and the next morning, we got to the stop. It turned out to be a railroad station, and I could see the signs of it, Auschwitz. After they had rolled back the doors from the boxcar and took the bar off, which closed it, and told everybody in very unpolite ways to get out, get going. So people were streaming out of this boxcar. People who had died in between were between the people carried out by the masses, and we had to get out. In front of this train depot was a decent, good-looking German officer standing. Uniform, SS uniform, pistol, a whip in his other hand, riding boots, but in total looking like a very well-kept man. Later we learned this was Dr. Mengele. And Mengele, after first splitting up all the groups of persons out of the boxcar, to women to one side, men to another side, old people to another group, women with children to another group. He told the group of women that young married women should step forward. And I think he took 24 of this group, and I was amongst them. I didn't have the chance to say goodbye to anybody. I didn't see to which group they were taken. We were put on a truck and taken to a big building, which later turned out to be the shower building, where all people were gathered. We had to take our clothes off. Our hair was shaved off. We got a cold shower, had to leave our clothes there, and were taken with clothes thrown at us from the transports, the clothing which was the least desirable. We were put in civic clothes, not prison clothes like the people mostly had, a blue and white striped jacket, and I think pants too, or dark pants, I don't remember that, but we had normal clothing. We were taken to a big building in a bunch of barracks. You could see the main street, and on both sides from the streets were brick buildings. What you learned later was these were the barracks where the soldiers had been housed, the soldiers' place, when the other camps were built, and that they had different quarters now, and that were the prison barracks. One of the barracks was the only women's barrack in the whole 20 set or 24 set of buildings. We were unloaded there, were told to go, I think, no, we're told to stand in that hallway downstairs. And then young people came and brought a piece of cloth with numbers on it, and these numbers were also tattooed on your arms. We had very little tattoo numbers. 47574, and that's who you became, not a person anymore, but a number. From the same number had to put on your clothing. And I really do not remember how we put it on. Where did we get the needle and thread from? I don't remember. But that we had to put on our clothing, and every day you had to stand in line in the hallway downstairs to be called off by number to check if everybody was still there, and probably take some who didn't look too good anymore out of that group. But when those young men came and tattooed the numbers, I had gone to the washroom, which had clay floor. And I'd taken some clay and rubbed it. And it came partly out. But after some days, I was caught, and they sent another artist over to make me another number. So it's a little bigger than the previous one, and if you would look real close, you could see the previous one and a triangle mingled with the new number. But we had to stand for this counting session. We were woken up by 5 o'clock, but you didn't know time, day, nothing. You were woken up with yelling and screaming, get going, get out of your beds. You had to make your bed immaculately, that they didn't see any creases or whatever on the straw mattress and the straw pillow and the horse blanket over it, and we had to stand downstairs every time to be counted. You had to say present when they called your number, and after the counting in the morning was done, you walked by a big barrel with a brown warm substance, undefinable, so-called coffee, tea, or whatever, but it was warm and it was drinkable. Because the water in the camp was said to be toxic. We couldn't drink it. That was the only fluid we got. In our food bowl, scooped up to everyone, and that was it. Then you went upstairs. And upstairs in the two big rooms were three high bunk beds. And we sat on them, and we get together on them, and we made some cultural time passing things, but you had nothing to do but to think from minute to minute what was going to happen the next minute. We didn't know anything. We didn't know where we were. We didn't know what was going on. And if you would be a prisoner, you would know so many years or so many weeks or so many months had to be gone. But we didn't know anything. Except I knew one thing, that when I got on the railroad track, where the people stepped on, what is it called? But anyway, on that gangboard, that I looked around and I thought by myself, I'm gonna make it. I don't know why, but I knew I would make it alone, by myself. And that seemed to be radiating for me, I think, most of the time. I had two things for me. I had this willingness, this will to get through, and also that I spoke German. So when they yelled some orders, I could know what it was and could right away react. Others who didn't got beaten up because they were not paying attention and so forth. But we had to go buy that barrel of liquid to upstairs and sit together, cooking in our minds, making menus, planning what are we going to do if this would ever end. And eventually some people were called by number to come downstairs. Downstairs seemed to be a laboratory or operating room and two sick rooms. Some of the people who came upstairs after they had been downstairs came up crying, but they didn't know what to tell us because it was some funny thing which they had done to them and they didn't know what it was for. It turned out that eventually everybody from these chosen people turned out to be guinea pigs, that there was a substance put into the vaginal area of the photo substance for contrast with different medications in it. And this was the try, which we later learned, of course, for mass sterilization. Because Hitler had made this plan that after he surrendered, after all the countries of Europe would surrender to him, he wouldn't even have to do these things. He had to take only the Jewish women and sterilize them, and then the next generation would be purely Aryan. That was his dream. The substances where they infused the people with were different consistency because they took pictures 3 months later to see how the situation had worked out. And eventually, practically everybody had been part of this experimentation. I was free of it till later because I had volunteered to work in the sick room downstairs where we had some scarlet fever come in from the last transport. And if the Germans would have known that there was scarlet fever, they would have taken the whole barrack and gassed it. So the Jewish doctor who was in charge of the building kept it quiet, asked somebody who would volunteer for it. I volunteered because I was in Berlin in a hospital for scarlet fever, so I thought I was immunized for it. And I was working there. And I could wait every time when I was called that I didn't have to go. But finally, regardless whether you had a position or not, you had to come, and that's how I learned what they did. We didn't know what they did. But in my case, I didn't have any pain. But some of them had a painful reaction to it. There was another room downstairs where another quote doctor, doesn't necessarily have to be the doctor, because one of the people who experimented with us, we heard, was a barber. But he was doing the experiments. But one of the rooms, there were 10 Greek girls taken from the group which had come into our barrack. They were operated cesarean style all organs removed and taped close and sent up again. Not stapled, no nothing, just taped crossways. I don't know how many of those died or didn't die. I have no idea, because you were living so much on yourself, trying to get through the day to the next day, that I had never paid much attention to it. And I had my patients downstairs, where I was called for to make the straw beds and get the soup bowls with food in. Later, the two nurses who were in charge of this room disappeared, and I had the room for myself to take care of. There wasn't much to do. We had only very few medical help to do. The only thing we could do was have saline substance in a big ear syringe and with a rubber hose, real smell hose, connect that ear syringe piece with a needle and get some salt water into the people who were dehydrated from being so sick with fever. And then we did it with two of us. I or somebody else would slowly press that substance in, and another one would sit and massage it in so it got absorbed to the body a little bit better. And it did help some people. Meanwhile, I had heard that my husband had come into the camp by the food carrier who were the nurses, male nurses, of a male sick barrack next to us. And from him I heard that my husband had arrived. And I could see him once through a little slit of the plywood, which was blocking our windows plus the bars, so you had nothing to go by. But there was a little slit there, and he would put my husband in front of that on his barrack, and I could see him. And the first thing my husband said, no, was I pregnant? Good thing I wasn't, because that wouldn't have been too favorable in that situation. But that was the only signal we had for each other, except that we could send little notes with this person back and forth. And I later sent him the little solid food which we got, a piece of bread and something to put on, like cheese or blood sausage or whatever. I sent that to him, and I lived on the soup. The meal meant soup. A big barrel, or more barrels, with some occasionally things swimming in it. If you were a friend of the scoopee, of the person who scooped it, she went down and dug some solids up. If you weren't a friend, she skimmed it from the top, and that was plainly just water. But I became friends of hers with her, and she scooped some more decent soup up for me. But that's my dimension now, because I have a big, big, big stomach and asked for more food than other people did. But the soup helped, although not too well, but it helped. And after a while, I got also the news that my husband had died there. According to the soup carrier from Barrack, he died with his tefillin, his prayer boxes on. You could organize everything in camp if you had the relationships for it. And that he died of tuberculosis. I doubt that now, because I have gotten some information from the Arlsberg archives, which confirms both of our entrance in the camp, but neither of us further than that. Maybe this young man had tried to spare me the things which I thought had worked out, that he was taken off the list of going to a selection truck, and that he was sent to the gas chamber. But according to him, he died of tuberculosis. And when I heard that news, I lost my beliefs. I was fairly orthodox, but only what I had learned in the kibbutz. And I couldn't say the night evening prayer anymore, because when he was living, at that moment I had contact with him, spiritual. But when he died, I started asking why such a religious person, why such a good person, and so forth, got to death. I lost it. We were in that barrack. I got diphtheria at that time, too. I was 12 days in coma, survived because the doctor who was in charge of our barrack had gotten hold of one syringe of the forerunner of what now is penicillin. It was even the name I remember, and I remember nothing nowadays. Globocet, that was called. It was the forerunner from penicillin. It hurt, and she gave it to me here. And I said at that moment, like a veterinarian, gone. But that's what I remember of it, nothing else. I survived. I got back to being a human being again. And that winter, we were taken out of the barrack. It was not in the winter. It was in the spring. All of them were taken out of the barrack and taken to another new-built building outside of the electric wire camp, which the old Auschwitz has been surrounded with. We got into that barrack, and no experiments were done anymore. I remember very little of that time. The only thing was I always volunteered for every kind of work that was requested. One day, in the beginning of my volunteerism, I got a little basket and had to go to one side of the outside where we were taken, put rocks in it and bring it to the other side. And the next day, we had to take the same rocks from that side back to this side. So this was something to be trying to be this, to make you feel how unimportant you were for them. But I always volunteered, and when we went out under guard with the soldier and dog, we sometimes could stop someplace on a side road and pick some green stuff. And there's quite some wild-growing plants which are edible. So I could supply myself with some additional food that way. And the vitamins, I'm now thinking of it. Maybe that's why I survived. But in that new barrack was only a sewing group on the attic of the building, on the slanted roof, on picnic benches and seats, repairing part of the brought in not so good clothing. I forgot to tell that the Germans would seal the house of all the people who they have taken to the camps, and later take everything out of those homes and send them to Germany to the bombed out districts. So they had a good supply of things. And in our case, the suitcases, which everybody brought, were collected, you never saw them again, in a big building which was called Canada. And there everything was sifted out. And when you went to Washington, D.C., to the Holocaust Museum, and you see the hair, that was all gathered in this kind of buildings, but also all medication which came in, sometimes valuables, and they peeled through the clothing to find if there was something hidden in it. The coat I later got had 100 or 1,000, whatever, I don't know, it was Austrian or Czech money, a big banknote, I still have it. In the lining of the shoulder pad. But of course it didn't do any good. But we were put in that barrack, and at that day I said to my neighbor girl, my friend, move over a little bit, I'm uncomfortable. I sat under that slanted roof and it was too close to me, so I said, move over a little bit. And half a minute later a big rock came through the roof. That was the only time that the Allied had bombed one of the factories real close by, and by the air pressure, probably, I don't know where it came from, but it came through the roof. Everybody upstairs tried to get downstairs, everybody downstairs tried to get upstairs. There were bars in front of the windows, and I remember a heavy-set Dutch woman who had diabetes and remained heavy-set that way, tried to squeeze through the bars and got stuck, and we had to pull her out later. But the door seat turned out to be open. The Germans were in the bomb shelter. They were not there, so we could walk out. But where would you walk to? Enemy country, in which you think that people at the neighborhood should at least know that these are prisoners, and they would denounce us and tell the Germans. So we did. None of us at that time tried to get out. And very soon afterwards, the Germans came out of the bomb shelter, herded us back in the building, and I remember very little of the time. This was in reconstructed to time, whatever, in September 44. What reconstructed again was January 18th. Everybody had to stand on counting session outside of the barrack. Minnesota weather, Minnesota snow, no decent clothing, but they were distributing coats. And, what I later learned, loaves of bread for each one. I didn't know that. I think I was looking in my coat if I could find something in there or so. But this other friend of mine came and said, "Margaret, how come you don't have a loaf of bread?" "What loaf of bread?" Well, they were distributing loaves of bread, and they had gotten one with the two of them together. But as I had taken care of them in the sick room when they were sick, now they would take care of me. I was sharing in that one loaf of bread. It turned out that we went on one of the death marches, 3 days and two nights, or two nights and 3 days. I don't know which one. Whoever couldn't walk and was not supported by somebody fell down in the snow, either got shot by the guard or got hounded by the dogs which were with them, or died in the snow, which I heard was a very graceful death because you slip away. But not everybody who went on that march arrived at the end destination. And I remember only one time having leaned against a window. Don't remember anything else. But when we got to our destination, which turned out the next railroad station, because the railroad was bombed, so we went to the next station, which was about, I think, 60 kilometers, 40-some miles, in 3 days and two nights. There were open boxcars standing there, and we were hounded into those boxcars, more than otherwise in it, so you had nothing to sit or whatever. You were pressed together like sardines. And I do remember that at a certain time, nature was calling, and we didn't have a bucket there. So we used one of our footballs for depositing, and as it was an open cart, I dumped it over the edge, and there was a German walking underneath there. And we heard terrific cussing, but he couldn't do a thing. He couldn't empty out and try and fight it between 100 people or something, or he couldn't dislodge the train part and get the train part out, so nothing happened. And it was the enforcement and the encouragement for us, for all the misery of that 3 days trip. Later we went, the train was, I don't know how many boxcars with it. They started rolling again. Once in a while you were set on a side road because there was some military things coming by. Then the prisoners had to wait, of course. And we finished up in Ravensbrück, which was a political women's camp close to Berlin. We didn't fit in there at all. Not only by what we were coming from, but there was no room. And they called for people to go to another camp. And as I always had volunteered, the three of us volunteered, got put, I think, on a truck, and I don't remember, and driven to a camp, turned out to be in Mecklenburg, but we later learned. It was a camp for people who didn't want to work for the Germans. And for punishment, they were put in these camps to do labor in the factories or whatever. And we were put in there on the floor, straw, like sardines. You had to give an order for that row, to turn, if you wanted to turn, then all of us turned. And if heavens forbid you had to go to the outhouse, you lost your spot because everybody moved a little bit and it was gone. So you had to wait on the side of the building till morning that everybody got up. And now I remember, I forgot to tell that all the time, that's when I froze my feet. And when I got up in the morning, I could feel that there was a big lump under my feet. And when I felt that it was not only under my feet, but on top too, it was a great big blister. And I don't know where I got a needle from, because I sat on the needle to sterilize it and then pricked those blisters and got the liquid out. And I had gotten a bandage of paper that I got. I don't know from whom. But I bandaged them with the paper bandage. And except neuropathy, which I have, I didn't have to have anything amputated or whatever. Other people did have their feet amputated, or toes amputated or something. But I still carry the result of that blister, I guess. But anyway, we were put in this labor force camp, slept on the floor, had to stand uphill outside, and a few of us were placed in work groups. One of us three was turned out to be put in the civilian kitchen. I finished up in a cardboard factory where they made little boxes for ammunition. But when the owners of this little factory heard who we were, they were aghast because they didn't know anything about it. They themselves had come from Leipzig, which was closer to the Russians, and they had gone away from there and put the little factory up in that place. And they bought right away portions of soup for us from the civil kitchen next to us, where my other friend was working. So we had a good time having food for a few days, the people who were working in this group. Hans, who was working in the kitchen, and I, we had made the signal, and I don't remember how, that when she went to the outhouse, she would carry something from the kitchen, and I would go to the outhouse and put it in the lining of my coat. They were checked every night if they would smuggle something, and we were not checked because why would we take cardboard along? So I could smuggle some of the things she had organized, stolen from the kitchen. But it was only a short time till somebody got the hang of it, that there was something good going on, and we were withdrawn from those functions. It was about 3 months that we were in that camp, and nothing was happening. I have very little memory of that also. But at that end of the month, first it was Hitler's birthday in April. And shortly after that, we heard quite some racket going on in the distance. Sirens and shooting and orders and masses of people somehow being moved there. And we thought, hey, something must be going on. And decided that maybe overnight we should stay up in case someone would come and liberate us and we could explain who we were. I volunteered for English, and a Polish woman who knew a little bit Russian volunteered for Russian. That night, nothing happened. But when I looked out in the morning by dawn, in the distance, I saw a prisoner with a white and blue jacket with an American flag. And I said by myself, Margaret, keep your mouth shut. You are hallucinating. Are you starting that now at the end of everything? Don't say anything. And I didn't. But half an hour later, other prisoners came and said, get out of here, you are free. And we didn't have anything to pack, nothing to take along. And we started walking. We were told to go to the west, that the Russians were coming from the east. We should go to the west, which we did, but also the thousands and ten thousands of Germans who had very guilty feelings because they had been ransacking in Russia when they were there, and they expected the same from the Russians, of course, so they tried to get away from them. We sat down on the side of the road sometimes with some other prisoners who were cooking something over fire and got a little piece of potato or something, but nothing to eat. And at night, instead of taking revenge like many did and threw the Germans out of their house or out of their farm, the three of us quartered ourselves in a chicken coop. It was nice and warm upstairs in the hay, and it smelled good compared to other smells. But in the morning, we found out we still haven't had anything to eat. So Ans, the most courageous of the three of us, said she would go and try and find some food. She came back with a suckling pig under her arm. And I said, Ans, for heaven's sake, first of all, who would kill it? There's nothing on it. Bring it back. Yeah, the farm woman had already looked so mad at her when she took it. And she came back with nothing, of course. We decided to take a chicken hostage. Not to slaughter it, because neither of us could have done that. And we didn't have any way to cook it. But we waited till it had laid an egg and then let it go again. We took the egg and put it in probably one of our previously used for other purposes food bowl, added a little water, and each drank two sips. Oh, we got sick. But we didn't have too much in our stomach, so it didn't take long that we had to throw up. And in the afternoon, we started joining the other masses again and finished up in the next city where the Russians already had come because they took a detour and had gotten there before we did. We were taken hold of by the Russian soldiers who interrogated us, everyone, all the other Germans too, and we could prove who we were by the number which we had and the way we could express ourselves, but what we were from. And one of the officers of the interrogation group went back to his jacket and came back with a dictionary, Dutch, Russian, of all things. And we asked him by pointing and trying to make each other understand, how come he has a Dutch dictionary? Well, he said as a child he was always so much interested in the history of Sir Peter, who had sent his son to Holland to learn the trade of shipbuilding. And he always hoped that someday he could visit in Holland and then by pointing on words in his dictionary could make himself understood. Very sweet. They put us up in a house where they had chased the Germans off. Of course, we were looking right away for food. There was nothing. A little piece of Dutch merk pepper, I think there was something there. But there was nothing there. And at night, a soldier came and brought us a loaf of bread. I don't remember if we had, very slightly remember, we were someplace in a canteen and got food. But I don't remember it. It's just in my subconscious. And there we learned that there was a Red Cross post close by. We asked for directions, and it was across a burning heather field. I don't know how we got through that, around it, or that there was a chance to go in between the flames. But when we got there to that next post, there was a Red Cross post, the French Red Cross. And they took care of the ones from the whole West Bloc too, the Polish and Russian and Hungarians and Czech and whatever. They didn't want to go to their own country back. So they had put, that's how the DP camps came into being. Displaced person, everyone who didn't have a country to go back to was placed in those, and we were taken by the Red Cross with trucks under Canadian soldiers' guard from town to town, stopping at night in improvised little places. They were not prepared that there were people coming that fast. And it took 6 days till we finally finished up in the southern part of Holland. Holland was still divided. The north part had been liberated when we were at the beginning of May. The south part had been liberated before the Ardennes offensive in September of the year before. So they didn't want any newcomers in that old district. They had to supply enough foodstuff and other supplies to have people come in and help the people there, because they had a hunger winter, it was called. They didn't have any food. I don't know what they ate and how they cooked. They burned their furniture to make a fire and cook whatever over it. But they had a miserable winter too, so they had to supply them first. And they put us up in a school after having been sanitized with DDT and gotten new clothing. At that time, my friends and I, we had lice finally after 2.5 years. We finally got stuck with lice and we sat as monkeys, licing each other. But that was then gone after the DDT treatment. We needed it. And we were put up in a school. In that school was also a priest. I don't know what, but I think he was a priest. Was rotating there, and I talked to him and said, could you find out if such and such a family is still living here? This was a relationship of my father-in-law at one jubileum or something else. I was introduced to these people. These were the manufacturers of the goods which he was wholesaler from. And he came back and said, yes, they are here. They want you right away to come. And I said, no way. We are three of us. Thank the people for us. And then he came back and said, no. The three of you can come. And I don't remember practically anything. I see a nice house, but I can't remember anything else. I only know that it was beautiful weather in the beginning of May. And our hostess had said, wait, you know what? You invite those three Canadians, which escorted you all the time, out here for a garden party. I make tea party. And the three Canadians and us three girls and our hostess were sitting there having tea when another Canadian walked in. And he went to the hostess and talked to her. First she had looked at us with a question mark. Is that one of yours too? No, they're here. So that young man walked up to her, talked to her, turned around and came up to me. It was my brother, who had volunteered in the Canadian Army when he was liberated. And he got a pass, and he was in uniform, Canadian uniform, and from him I learned that my mother and my father had survived. And he brought some stuff which my mother had saved for me, some silk underwear, which I needed as a hole in my head at that time, and 10 guilders, and I couldn't do anything with the guilders, but you felt as a royalty having 10 guilders. Well, after a while, they opened up the demarcation line from the visitors, and the three of us went with the first train running to Amsterdam. There we split up. Everybody had to try to find something. I found the in-between address of my father, of course, easily, but it was a good 45 minutes walk. And the other girl, Anne, went to where she thought her cousins were living. They were mixed marriage and had survived, and they were still living in that same house. And later I learned that after a while that she was still there, I think after 2 months, somebody came to the doorbell and rang, and there's a staircase going like that, so you have to look down and talk down with the one who comes in. And this young man said he was coming to find a picture of his late wife. And instead of his late wife, he found his wife there. So, and I found the address, and the Canadians, Canadian, which I was friends with, came and visited once in a while till he was sent back. And I had corresponded with his wife for 50 years till she finally passed away. And he was so decent to order his daughter to send me the obituary. But I've never had contact with him anymore, only with his wife. But I was also then living in the house where my father was hiding. I had a box, a tin box, with K rations under my bed, and I ate them day and night. I had to put up some weight again, and I did. And that was my liberation. Later, my mother came back from the country to Amsterdam, and the three of us rented a place in what would be now a boarding house. Pension, it was called. We rented the rooms there and had kitchen facilities, I think. And that was my liberation. And at that time, I tried to make up for lost time, and you can't. I ate and drank and went out and brought my parents to head shaking because they didn't expect their daughter to be like that. So I had to make up with the lost years. And after a year, there was an anniversary celebration. And I went to that celebration and met a young man who had come from a camp in Indonesia. He was caught as a merchant marine boat somehow and got into an island and was found out by the Japanese, and he was in a Japanese camp all those years. And we became friends, and we thought we could build a better world. So we were planning on marrying, and then I couldn't get married because I didn't have a death certificate for my husband. And it takes 5 years and 5 months till you can declare somebody dead. So we got married after that time, had a good, very nice apartment. He started the business together with my father for my money, and later walked out after they had the first setback, and he had my father sit there with those bales and bales and bales of goods. So after I came to the States, before I went, I gave it all to the Red Cross. And my father had a chance to keep on making a living by selling it for a dime, a dollar or something like that. But they had some extra income that way, and that helped too. But after, in total, 13 years, I think, I gave up on him because I was not number one. I was number three. He had bought, also with my money, a record shop, a radio record shop, and the girl who was working there was the main person of the job. He didn't know too much about it. She was very important to him. She came to live with us in our house. When we went on vacation, she went with us on vacation. So she was more or less an adopted daughter for me. And one time he went to Germany to have his suit altered. Okay, I was by myself. And I went first to a psychiatrist, then to the Jewish community, and then to a lawyer. And I applied for divorce, which I got with trouble because he didn't want to let me go. I had to go into second time of hiding. I went into a sanatorium, and a place where people were to recuperate, and boarded myself there. My parents didn't know where I was. My friends didn't know where I was. I was the one who could only take contact with them. And indeed, he had tried to persuade my father to tell him where I was and whatever, but I didn't. He didn't. After the divorce was through, I applied for a visiting visa and came here where my brother was living here in Minneapolis. He was transferred from Pillsbury, New York, where he was living for 6 years already, to Minneapolis, and shortly after that got fired. So they were not in too good circumstances either. They were expecting a baby, and that was the reason why I came to America for. And I had gone and visited a lot of friends all around, and then stayed with my adopted pa and ma, and I was their adopted daughter. And we were friends from in Holland when they visited one time. And they said there was always a room for me there, and I did, and I was there for 3 months. And then when the baby was due, came back to Minnesota. The baby didn't come. I got the baby out of my nostrils from hearing Dr. Spock stories all day. And I said, I got to get out of here. And I went to the bus stop, meaning to go to Dayton's in downtown. And the bus went away right in front of me. And I was mad. And there was another lady coming. And we were together met at the book at the bus and talked together. And I told her I had just come from California. It was so nice out there. The people were friendly. And the weather was friendly. And she said, "Well, I have a daughter who goes out sometimes with a boy from Holland, and I'll call his parents," which she did. And after a few weeks, they asked for how they could pick me up. I was taken home with them to go to a Dutch club meeting, which turned out I didn't. Rudy came in. We started talking. And after some months, till my visa was over, I promised I would try to come back. And I did. I applied for immigration visa, got it very fast, came back in January 61. We got married, and we were together for 44 years, till he died now 3 years ago. Some questions?
Thank you very much, Margot, and nice toss of the latrine pot.
How old were you when you were liberated, and what year did you actually first come to America?
I was 22 when I got taken to Switzerland and finished up in a camp. And what was I going to say? And I was 2 years, 2 months, and 2 days from leaving the home in Amsterdam to returning to the home in Amsterdam. 2 years, 2 months, and two days. Don't be shy. I answer questions for kids. I can do it for adults, too.
Can you comment on sort of the new Germany? I mean, how new is it? And
I left Germany in 1932 when I was 11 years old, with my parents and my brother. Come on. Was I so explicit that you understood everything? Couldn't be.
Oh, we have some questions from persons listening over the web.
Okay.
So, Paul, and thank you for the recording.
Pleasure. There's a two-part question from a listener tuned in on the web today. In Elie Wiesel's book, La Nuit, The Night, he talks of the importance of keeping one's humanity even when dehumanization is at its height. The first part of her question is, how did you do this? And the second part of her question is, how do you think Americans today can do this? How do we make sure that we're seeing people as humans, not as objects or units of productivity?
How not to treat them as humans, I can't answer. But life was a little bit different at that time. And there was nothing like adopting or whatever in that time. And I had two operations and then learned that I probably couldn't have children. So otherwise I would have adopted something. But now I grew up with my husband, and after he was gone, now I'm lonesome. But in general, most people got remarried. Some of them got together with their old husbands. Some of them had kids who had the experiments done. There were two, which I know of, had a baby. Others didn't. So that was taken care of. And in a way, you had to find your mate that way, because you had to inform that you couldn't have children.
There are so many issues concerning the aftermath of feelings and of, you know, from the experiences. And we had just had Ava Kaur here, whose, you know, feelings now have evolved to forgiveness. Can you express a little bit about where you're coming from, as far as your feelings from the whole situation that you've been through?
Yeah, I can express that in some way. First of all, I lost my beliefs, so I had to find some other beliefs who made me more fitting into the society. One way, I claim to be the first liberated woman because I did and ate and whatever came in my head, I did. And my parents shook their heads, probably very often, but I had to make up in time. And now I have found a belief way which is a mixture of all religions. And it supports me in, and find people who think the same way too. I believe that everything is connected with the other. Nothing stands alone. I don't believe in death. I saw when my brother died, I saw his soul go away from him. And my belief is that I believe in that the soul keeps alive, and according to what you've done in this step, that you are placed in the next function.
I just have a question about before you did that 40-kilometer walk to the...
What?
The 40-kilometer walk to the new camp.
Yeah.
Who gave you the coats and the loaves of bread?
The coats when we went on the road?
Yes.
The Germans, from all the goods which had come in from the transports.
Okay.
And I had a very nice coat.
Have you had any contact with people that you were in the concentration camp with?
Yeah. My friends I kept in contact with. One died in 65 of ovarian cancer. And the other one lived in the United States, which I visited here. And like with so many of us, I have always called her. And now the telephone was disconnected with no forwarding address. And that is also from the girl who died in 65, her husband. The last letter I had that he was going to come and visit us here in Minneapolis, and he disappeared. I don't know what and when. I heard over Israel, one of the people he visited there, that he had died, but I don't know what happened. And I think that's the danger of being left alone. I had made a list of people which should be called in case I come to die, which would happen, of course. Of those, that list, maybe one or two still exist. And I haven't had the courage to do the next list.
What percentage of the people that you were in the experimental block with would you say perished there?
There, in that time, nobody perished.
They were all, you all made it
we
out
all
of there, okay?
We went on that march. And how many in the march died, I don't know.
When you were experimented upon as a woman, did they ever explain to you what they were doing or why they were doing what they were doing? Did the doctors ever say anything to you when they were conducting those tests?
No, we didn't know anything. They didn't tell us anything. They didn't have to tell us anything. When something was told to you, you did what you were told.
My question is, I guess, I'm an identical twin, and I know that Mengele had quite a fascination with twins, and he would do experiments upon them. And I was told, had I lived in that time, that I would be one of the first experimented upon. Do you have any knowledge of what he was so curious about or what he was looking at in regards to that?
No, in our case, it took a while till you found out what it was. And later now, in this year, I've read so many books which confirmed my way of understanding and thinking. But he had some compies working for him, which were not necessarily doctors. And he went out really to first distinct the good race against the bad race. And I think he has had some special women issues. For the rest, I can't say anything.
I'm sorry, what was that?
Women issues.
Oh, apparently.
Yeah. There, the lecture by Hans-Walter Schmuel about the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute for Anthropology, Human Heredity, and Eugenics, he talks a little bit about that, about what Mengele's interest was with twins. He was in part interested in questions of expression and variability between twins, and also questions, for example, when one person had a blue eye or a brown eye, and it was different in the other twin, and they was trying to construct particular phenotypical expression models. And so one thing to be noted is a lot of the data was sent back to the Kaiser Wilhelm Institute, and it wasn't just one crazy MD, PhD named Mengele who was there, but Fischauer and other people that were at the height of the scientific pinnacle.
Another listener on the web says, do you know of women who had been experimented upon that did go on to have children?
Yes, I know of two women who had to test and had children. And one very, very strangely, this is a strange friend of mine who is a UFO admirer and has, for according to her, she has been taken by the UFOs and taken up and has a mark on her breast from it. But she had chosen a man which had all the qualities she wanted to have for a child. And she was not married with him. She didn't know him even. She just chose him. And they produced a daughter. But the daughter's just as crazy as she is.
Yes, I was just wondering about the tattoo. Have you ever thought about having it removed? Or what if people see it and they ask you about it, just what you tell them or what your thoughts about having it on you are?
No. When I came to the States, my brother requested me to put a Band-Aid on my number, because he did not want to be known as a Jew. There was still quite some discrimination going on. You couldn't become a member of certain clubs. You couldn't buy or rent a house in certain areas. So he must have been, by his hiding time probably, obsessed with something, which I don't share. But he didn't want to know it. And other people in the beginning, the kids who asked me, I would say, either it's my laundry mark or my telephone number that I don't forget. So I never had tried to hide it. I never have thought to take it out because I earned it. That's all.
Well, Margot's chauffeur asked to ask one further question, and that's a prerogative of the chauffeur.
Someone had asked earlier how you feel about forgiveness. And I know how you feel, but it's important. Okay.
Well, first of all, what many people do, they hate their oppressor. I don't know hate. I only know hate falls back on the hater, not on the hatee. You only ruin your life by hating, by being obsessed. One of the three of us, the one in Miami, she was obsessed with hate. And that is not my way of thinking. I, in a way, feel sorry for, let's say it, what they used to call it, a race, who had so many permanent scientists and geniuses in their lives that they could sink so low and follow these unhuman instructions.
Well, as a final word on the lecture portion of this series, I think that was really very fine. And I want to thank you for coming and spending this time
with us.
Thank you.